This podcast was recorded on the stolen lands of the Kumbumeri people of the Yugambeh language region. Sovereignty of these lands was never ceded. I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all First Nations people. Before we start, I'd like to provide a content warning. This podcast contains discussions of violence that some may find distressing. If this raises any issues for you, please contact 1-800-RESPECT or Lifeline on 13 11 14. When you hear the words domestic and family violence, what do you see? Is it physical violence? A lapse in judgment? Maybe it's a heated argument gone wrong. Now, imagine the victim of this violence. What does she look like? You may have heard of something called coercive control, a term that's used to depict the enduring nature of domestic and family violence. Violence that's often non-physical and undetectable to people outside the relationship. In the last few years, the issue has continued to gain public attention. But outside of the domestic and family violence sectors, there's limited understanding of what it is and how we should respond. Sociologist Professor Evan Stark was the first to use the term, defining coercive control as a malign pattern of domination, used by a perpetrator, usually a man, to isolate, degrade, exploit, and control their victim, usually a woman, and a current or former partner. This can include tactics like humiliation, gaslighting, sexual coercion, surveillance, psychological, technological, and financial abuse, also known as intimate terrorism. This pattern of behaviours works to entrap the victim, destroying their sense of self, safety, and independence. Many victim survivors say the emotional torment they suffered was often worse than the physical abuse they experienced. Coercive control is the common denominator in relationships characterised by domestic and family violence, and is now considered a more significant predictor of intimate partner homicide than a history of physical abuse within the relationship. These acts, viewed in isolation, may seem unremarkable, but when understood collectively, we start to see the bigger picture of intimate partner violence. No longer viewed as discrete acts of physical violence, but a complex cycle of abuse that infiltrates every aspect of the victim's life. In the last 5 years, England, Wales, and Scotland have introduced legislation that made coercive control a criminal offence. For decades in Australia, survivors, along with experts and academics in the sector, have urged that the law recognised what we know now as coercive control as domestic abuse. Following the devastating murders of Hannah Clark and her three children, Aaliyah, Trey, and Liana, the call for criminal action and better education on coercive control and domestic and family violence has been louder than ever. Criminalising coercive control is not a quick fix solution to domestic and family violence in Australia. It may be a step in the right direction, but real change isn't tangible without addressing the systems, constructs, attitudes, and beliefs that continue to enable perpetrators and disempower victim survivors. The Women's Safety and Justice Task Force was established in 2020 after the Queensland government made an election commitment to criminalise coercive control. And since then, the task force have released multiple reports with the title Hear Our Voice. The reports make hundreds of recommendations that seek to reform the justice and domestic and family violence sectors in the favour of victim survivors. The task force made it clear that system-wide reform is required prior to any creation of a new offence. I wanted to speak to the volunteers, experts, and academics that have dedicated their lives to this issue to find out exactly what this reform looks like across different areas of the sector and how we might achieve these recommendations before any laws are passed. One of the most significant recommendations made by the task force was an independent commission of inquiry into Queensland Police response to domestic and family violence. The commission is still ongoing, but the information we've received so far, including submissions from current and former officers, has illustrated a culture of misogyny, racism, and masculinity that is deeply ingrained into the structure of policing. The reality is that the current nature of policing is incompatible with what is required to protect victim survivors, and police are under-trained and ill-equipped to identify situations of domestic and family violence and respond adequately. Recent data suggests that only 1 in 10 women affected by domestic and family violence will seek help from police, and by the time they do, they have exhausted all other options to navigate the safety concerns in their relationship. when a woman goes to the police, she enters a lucky dip of sorts. It's left to chance whether she's met with an experienced, trauma-informed officer or one that's dismissive or simply indifferent. Having a negative or invalidating experience with police further isolates victim survivors and can deter them from seeking help in the future. Dr. Silky Mayer is a criminologist and social worker. She's researched extensively on women and children's experience of domestic and family violence and related help seeking.
Very often, unless the victim survivor presents with very clear evidence of harm, you know, ideally physical injuries at the time police is interviewing or attending a call out, victim survivors often report that the police responses can vary greatly. I've seen that across studies now that victim survivors report dismissive attitudes or, you know, either being turned away, saying to come back at a different time when a specialist DV officer is available, not being taken seriously, or being questioned around, you know, what is it that they contributed to the situation, or has this happened before? And if you haven't reported it before, why are you coming now?
Despite the growing awareness and support services available, victim survivors are still being met with stereotypical victim-blaming attitudes when disclosing their experiences to police, as well as friends and family. Although we know that separation poses the highest risk for a woman experiencing domestic and family violence, victim survivors are still being treated as though they are complicit or responsible in their own abuse if they return to or stay with a violent partner. Empathy and support seem to be reserved for victims who are seen as vulnerable and blameless in the process of their victimisation.
So I think aside from how a victim survivor may already present on her own, there's also the element that if you have a really strategic, manipulative perpetrator, then you have the risk that he's going to make sure she's not going to look like an ideal victim in need of protection.
Time and time again, victim survivors have been let down, disbelieved, misidentified, and re-traumatised by police. These documented police failures were clearly identified in the coronial inquests into the deaths of Queensland women Hannah Clark and Doreen Langham. Both inquests found that police were presented with ample opportunity to hold the perpetrators accountable and ultimately failed to protect these women. These documented police failures were clearly identified in the coronial inquests into the deaths of Queensland women Hannah Clark and Doreen Langham. Both inquests found that police were presented with ample opportunity to hold the perpetrators accountable and ultimately failed to protect these women. Kerry Carrington is an adjunct professor at the University of the Sunshine Coast and has been researching gendered violence for over three decades. Kerry provided crucial evidence at Doreen Langham's inquest, finding that Doreen had interacted with 16 different police officers in the 2 weeks leading up to her death.
All of this research in Queensland has identified a systemic pattern of problems with the police culture. Now, that police culture, what stems from being male-dominated, the policing was a male-only profession for much of the first century of its existence. So very entrenched masculine values. And then in the 1980s, suddenly, when there were very few women in the police force, and today there's only about 25% of officers are sworn, and not many of them are in senior positions.
When responding to a complaint, police are often trained to find the criminal offence in the situation, and the solution is usually quick and simple. Kerry has done extensive research on women-led police stations in Latin America, designed specifically to support victim survivors and prevent gender-based violence. Officers are trained to work from both gender and culturally sensitive perspectives. Kerry believes adapting similar protocols in Australia could greatly improve the way we police domestic violence. Many experts agree that we need to reimagine policing when it comes to domestic and family violence. In our current system, police, the judiciary, and domestic and family violence support services often work independently.
You look at, you know, Scotland and Wales, who have already criminalised coercive control, and they have the designated kind of domestic and family violence branch within the police ranks, because you can't expect, you know, a regular duty officer to be able to handle something as complex.
You certainly can't. And you also, but the other thing is law enforcement officers bring a law enforcement perspective, whereas social workers and domestic violence workers and counsellors bring a trauma-informed, victim-centric perspective. And you need to have those combined.
What we need is an integrated approach, similar to Latin America's, where these specialist police stations are made up of multidisciplinary teams of police, social workers, psychologists and lawyers.
Argentina introduced these stations precisely to increase police legitimacy and trust. It's actually a trust-based policing model.
Domestic and family violence is one of the biggest contributors to women and children's homelessness in Australia. Finding appropriate accommodation is difficult enough amidst Australia's housing crisis. But for women fleeing domestic and family violence, often with children and very little means to support themselves, it seems almost impossible. Advocates and survivors say there isn't enough crisis accommodation available for women escaping violence, and the existing refuges are almost always at full capacity. For many victim survivors facing housing insecurity, staying with or returning to an abusive partner may seem safer than the options available to them. Research done by Dr. Silky Mayer, who I spoke to earlier in the episode, suggests this is common when children are involved.
We know that long-term, very often women and children still face housing instability and or homelessness because the family home, even if they're initially entitled to stay, often becomes unsustainable, either because it's financially, because you previously had two parties financially contributing to maintain that family home, but also often because we know that perpetrators will continue to abuse, manipulate, utilize lengthy family law court proceedings and so forth to make it financially unsustainable, I guess, in the long run, and also unsafe and undesirable, because essentially staying in the home means the perpetrator will always know where she and the children are, whereas if eventually she moves out, she has an opportunity to find some safety and anonymity elsewhere, even if she has to have ongoing contact around, facilitating handover of children for shared care arrangements or anything like that.
Simone Patterson was frustrated at the lack of government action and housing support available for victim survivors. She decided she had to do something. Simone started the Sanctuary Refuge here on the Gold Coast 6 years ago.
We're a very unique refuge that we take boys over 12 and we take pets, which other refuges don't do. 31 children have been killed so far this year. It's terrible. The stats speak for themselves. Children are the weapon, so are the pets, and that's why we take the pets, because it's very hard to find a place to live when you've got a pet. We try and keep as much of the family together as what we can.
Has it been difficult to get the support that you need to continue to help these women?
It's horrendous. It's been 6 years. The government haven't helped. The government haven't stepped up. The state government are lacking so much that we struggle to keep the doors open. We struggle to keep going. And it's hard when, I thought very hard about this and I thought the government would come in and help.
Unfortunately, the police are not the only system causing further harm to victim survivors of domestic and family violence. While legal action may be a necessary step in a woman's search for safety, researchers in the sector say that engaging in legal processes can facilitate the ongoing control and abuse, acting as an extension of the perpetrator. One of the most common tactics used by perpetrators manipulating the legal system is making counter-allegations and cross-applications for protection orders. We can identify this as what's known as the DAVO technique, straight out of the perpetrator's handbook. Deny, attack, reverse victim and offender.
It was something that I remember seeing at Women's Legal Service already happening. I remember one of our clients, I think she was in the family court, a civil debt court and the protection order court, all courtesy of her ex, who was, doing his best to keep her busy with, legal disputes. That particular tactic that is used, that is part of the coercive control toolkit for some guys, it's used across the spectrum. It's used in family law. It's used in protection order.
Yeah.
That's the whole mutual order thing.
Yeah.
And, it's used at the doorstep of the house.
Mm-hmm.
G'day, mate.
Zoe Rathis is a senior lecturer at the Griffith University Law School and was coordinator of the Women's Legal Service for 15 years. Since turning to academia, Zoe's focus has been on women and the law, particularly the family court system. For many victim survivors with children, going through the family court post-separation proves to be the most devastating. In Australian family law, maintaining a relationship with both parents is in the best interest of the child. Despite having evidence of a history of domestic and family violence, a mother's efforts to protect her children may be seen as obstructive, an attempt to alienate the father from his children.
One of the things about the way that I saw that the family law system was now operating and the way that they'd written that new Family Law Act or the changes to the Family Law Act, it really meant the courts were required more and more to look to the future about what can happen in that family as opposed to look back at what did happen. Talked a lot about that idea of the future. And when you, one of the things that happens when they talk about the future, there then is this very deep focus on what's happened since separation. Will that woman facilitate contact between the father and the children, because that's what it's all about now. Yeah. So you get this focus on the post-separation conduct of everybody, not the pre-separation. And so the father then runs the line that, you know, whatever she says, he really wasn't very bad. Maybe some things happened a bit. And really the problem now is that she's not facilitating his relationship. And that's a form of abuse. And actually he's the victim here.
It's unclear whether implementing coercive control laws will improve the experience of victim survivors in the family court system. And if these laws are passed, policymakers and reform advocates says there needs to be careful consideration to ensure legal systems abuse isn't made easier to perpetrate. So we know that making coercive control an offence will only change legislation in the criminal justice system. Can we assume that it might influence family law proceedings as well?
There's some discussion also about whether changing the conversation in the criminal law sphere might mean that we do think about some of these things differently in the family court, one state and one's federal, and never the twain shall meet. You know, every time we build knowledge, it crosses those silos.
We've talked about the police, what it's like to seek help as a victim survivor, the criminal and the family court, and how the state itself can occupy the role of the perpetrator. The urgent need for wide-scale reform across all these systems is unmistakable. What we haven't discussed yet is the most significant risk we're presented with when considering coercive control in a criminal context. These laws pose a heightened vulnerability to First Nations women, where the existing risks associated with victim survivors interacting with these systems are tenfold. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women already face racial discrimination. They're overrepresented in the prison population, less likely to be believed by law enforcement, and at a greater risk of experiencing homelessness. Going back to the concept of the ideal victim, women that fight against their abuser or aren't cooperative with police tend to be misidentified as perpetrators, an issue that disproportionately affects Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women. We see the lasting effects of colonisation and the stolen generation, contributing to the distrust of authorities in First Nations communities. And Dr. Silky Mayer says fear of child removal is a powerful deterrent for First Nations women when seeking help in situations of domestic and family violence.
The fear of child protection is a huge barrier, you know, in general, but particularly when it comes to reporting to police or anybody who may notify to child protection. Mothers are well aware, as you say, that if they do reach out for help to sources, for example, like police, let's say it is a, you know, it's a high-risk incident and they consider ringing the police. If there's children in the home, then police have an obligation to notify.
Indigenous activists and abolitionists are concerned that a further extension of power by the state will harm First Nations women and is not the solution to gender-based violence. This presents an ongoing dilemma for advocates, reformers, and victim survivors seeking to end domestic and family violence. Laws intended to make men accountable interpret gender-based violence as an individual issue, neglecting the social, cultural, and historical context that exist to enable it. Sociologist Tamar Pitch argues that the process of criminalisation universalises the problem but privatises its causes. Feminism regards men's violence against women as a function of the patriarchy. where traditional masculine norms continue to structure our most powerful institutions. Dr. Josephine Brown is a sociologist and narrative therapist with a focus on mainstream masculinities and violence, coercive control, and social collusion in domestic violence. I spoke to her about the link between masculinity and violence and the key messages we receive from a young age.
So one of the particular areas that I'm interested in my research is the connection between violence and romance. In narrative therapy, we talk about how people, like individual people, engage with dominant discourses and dominant stories. Obviously, one of these stories that men inherit, just to say the masculine side, conceptualizations of heterosexual relationships where a woman is a therapist, a nurse, a house cleaner, the mother of the children, always mothering, very satisfied and fulfilled in mothering. So all of this whole package of ideals that are deployed in, you know, normative heterosexual romance stories begin with children's movies. We have constructs of the feminine needing the masculine. So in terms of masculinity, that's where these, you know, these concepts of entitlement.
The highly acclaimed work from sociologists and gender theorists like Raewyn Connell and Judith Butler explore gender as a large-scale social construct, considering gender as a performance, an act we learn in early socialisation.
Raewyn Connell's work for me here is really powerful because it's very much that concept of masculinity as a performance for other men. And the attainment of masculinity, because it's associated with power, it doesn't reference femininity because femininity is powerless. Masculinity wants to be affirmed by other masculinity. Yep. So if you don't have a woman that, you know, given this sort of romance narrative, that's, you know, stays home, cleans the house, not necessarily even stays home, but despite working, does it all, you know, loves to be a mother and mother all of her leisure time.
Too often it feels like the responsibility has been left to women to find a solution to gender-based violence. And we need more men joining the discussion. Perpetrators or not, all men benefit from this dominant position in society.
Because it's very easy to say, well, these men don't participate in those practices, but these men benefit from the practices of other men. Even if you're not participating in it, you benefit from it because there are assumptions embedded in our culture and in all cultures about how men should behave and how women should behave. Yeah. That's what Connell calls the patriarchal dividend.
Shifting these cultural attitudes and beliefs around issues as pervasive as gender and domestic and family violence is extremely complex. Along with the wide-scale reforms we've already discussed, scholars say education and early intervention is fundamental to changing the narrative. In the last few years, we've seen the use of respectful relationship programs grow across high schools in Australia. But some academics believe intervention needs to start much earlier.
You know, year 5 and 6, often people say that's the really challenging years in terms of the gender stereotypes and the enforcement of them in groups. And then you move into high school where then people are thinking about, the young people are thinking about relationships. Mm-hmm. Then you're in a different space and programs like Love Bites and stuff and just general querying is, you know, being brought more and more into schools.
Similar recommendations have been made previously in government task forces, reviews and reports spanning from 1988 to 2020. Very rarely have they resulted in tangible change. At this stage, Queensland is set to implement coercive control laws by the end of 2023. We can only hope that these new laws will act as intended to protect victim survivors and hold perpetrators accountable. Those in support of criminalisation believe a new offence could have a trickle-down effect into broader society. But laws won't change culture, especially if we aren't using a gendered lens when understanding and legislating on domestic and family violence. If we don't address the failures of the current system and achieve the large-scale reforms we've been talking about, we risk causing greater harm to those we are trying to protect. And this risk needs even greater consideration when it comes to marginalised communities and our First Nations women.